The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show EDU edition for this week. We finished up our Ed Slot quiz questions last week, so we're going to dive into a new topic. And today's topic was kind of influenced, if you will, by a couple of articles that were sent to us by listeners that were talking about how retirees tend to treat income coming to them in retirement differently than their other financial assets or resources. In other words, there's a difference in spending behavior, whether a retiree is spending income that might come in, particularly lifetime income like Social Security, pensions, annuity income, versus how they spend from assets. And some interesting things were pointed out in the article, and the listeners felt that it related somewhat to our approach. So we're going to talk a little bit about these recent articles and kind of do a compare and contrast on what they're saying versus kind of what our philosophy is in regard to this, because we certainly talk about utilization of lifetime income sources in retirement on a fairly regular basis. And we talk about, you know, spending your own assets in retirement, the reason why you saved them, I'll remind you. And that quite a challenge for a lot of people is actually seeing those assets drop as they spend them, after they spend a lifetime building them up. So there's an emotional behavioral issue in retirement that many, many, many people face, which leads a lot of them, honestly, to underspend in retirement. And that was also a point of these articles, as you'll see when we talk about them. So, Jim, I'll invite you in, and you can maybe embellish anything that I said about these articles and who sent them in, but I think people have an idea where we're headed today.
No, I think you did a great job. I got the idea for this show, folks, and welcome to the EDU version of the Retirement and IRA Show. As Chris said, I am Jim Salnier, as we've agreed. We'll stop pronouncing it the way my meme used to pronounce it to my dad. And you just heard Chris Stein, and together we form, I guess, the JNC. I guess we don't really have a cat. Well, we do. You're Cowboy and I am Bugs. So we are the Bugs and Cowboy of the Retirement and IRA Show. And if you don't know what Chris and I are talking about there, then you're not a longtime listener. But Chris is Bugs, I am Cowboy. No, Chris is Cowboy, I'm Bugs. And I should be Bugsy, by the way, but no, we won't go there. It's Bugs. And that should have been Bugsy. You know it, and I know it. But well, apparently when you're given
two different characters.
When you're given a call signal, you cannot complain about it or change it.
It's a call sign, fighter pilot. Not call signal. Call sign, not call signal.
You sure?
I'm sure.
Or whatever it is we have. Chris is cowboy. I'm Bugs. I should be Bugsy, but I'm Bugs. And this is the Retirement IRA Show. And the way I got the idea for this discussion today was in July. Pretty much, goodness, folks, I think literally I'm going to try to open up the email. Pretty much a day apart, 2 days apart. So I originally got sent the research report that we're going to be talking about in a roundabout way. I will see if I can find the research report was sent to me as a PDF, and I don't think there's any way we can attach a PDF to the show notes, or if there is, we don't know how to do that. But I will see if we can actually find the link. It's a free research report. So we can get it from the Retirement Income Institute, I'm sure. We will try to post a link directly to the research report from the Retirement Income Institute that we're going to be referencing a lot. That came to me first on the 26th. Then on the 28th, somebody sent to me a little blurb, if you will, from the Kiplinger's Retirement Report. Which, if you know Kiplinger's magazine, I don't know if the magazine, physical magazine, is still available anymore or if it's just all online. But back in the day when I subscribed to Kiplinger's, I also would get like the Kiplinger's tax report, the Kiplinger's retirement report that this gentleman who sent it to me subscribes to. And they were kind of, they were literally monthly little newsletter style mailings that came to me. You know, 8.5 by 11 paper folded over with circles stamped in it so I could put it in a 3-ring binder. And they had all these different reports. And there's a tax report, there's the retirement report, and others. So he clearly subscribes to this. And he sent me just this little one-page blurb that was referencing, in plain English, a lot of the academic doublespeak from the research report. But both podcast listeners felt the little Kiplinger's article and then the deeper research report reflected a lot of what Chris and I espouse on this show, and they felt it would make for a good discussion on the show. And so did I. And that's what we're going to do today, but a little bit differently. I'm not going to walk page by page through the research report. Because even though it's written in English, you can't understand it, or at least I can't, half of the stuff they're saying. It is written in that academic, gobbledygook, doublespeak research style. And it was a painful read. I got through it, but it's not a smooth, interesting read at all. It's, you guys might geek out on it because you are VGers. A lot of you are engineers. Some of you might be scientists. Chris, did you read the whole report? I know I sent it to you, but you're an academic.
I skimmed it. It was a bit long for me to read before recording.
True. I sent it to you a whole 5 minutes before we came on.
But I did skim through it. Looked at the graphs, some of the description
pretty
on
pictures.
The graphs. Yeah.
There'll be a link in there, folks, and you all can read through it. But I did gather some good information from it. That does support, to a degree, what Chris and I say a lot on the show. The article from the Kiplinger's retirement report, that is written in plain English, talking to the researcher. And the two researchers who came up with this report, we've talked about and quoted many a times, David Blanchett and Michael Fink. Or Finca, is that how we agreed we're going to say it?
Chris, I think it's Finca, yeah.
Finca. Michael Finca and David Blanchett. We've spoken about both of those people on this show in the past. They're very well respected in our industry. And when I say our industry, I'm not just necessarily talking about the financial services industry. I'm talking about the retirement planning industry. So the Kiplinger's article, which I cannot, I'll read it. It's very short. So you're going to have the entire little article read. I do not subscribe to the retirement research report from Kiplinger's. I try to access it to put a link to it. You can't. You've got to pay. But then I also realize this thing is just a page long. I'm going to end up reading it all. You don't really need to access it. But the Kiplinger's article is in plain English. And then we're going to dive into some of the findings that did come out of the research report. And I think you guys will find it interesting. I think for those of you who are still trying to figure out how you're going to approach retirement, I think this is going to give you some good food for thought. But a couple of things I do want to make mention of. And it's really to understand the Kiplinger's article is based on a research report. It's a research report from the Alliance of Lifetime Income. Now, they have a research arm that is called the Retirement Income Institute. Both Blanchett and Finca are fellows there. What's a fellow, Chris?
He's a member, I guess, is one easy way of describing it, where you are considered a contributor to that entity, generally in an academic sense, I guess would be my best crack at describing that.
Okay. Well, they're both research fellows for the Retirement Income Institute. But I do want to make mention of a few things, because you do have to wonder, did the researchers go in with a preordained idea, preordained conclusion, and try to work backward? Did they go in with the idea of, gee, we like annuities, we should convince people to purchase annuities? And the only reason I'm cautioning on that is I don't want someone, because you all are smart people, to say, hey, you know, it's the insurance industry that sponsored this, and the Alliance for Lifetime Income is just a group of insurance companies, even though, yes, it's a 501c3 nonprofit, it's funded nearly entirely from annuity providers. And that David Blanchett, one of the researchers, works for Prudential, and Prudential sells annuities. So we can't overlook any of that. And I want to make it perfectly clear. But I do feel comfortable with the research report and some of the conclusions that they created. And I feel comfortable with them because they do base it. They do base it on a good study. And we'll get into a little bit more of the data sets and the study that they relied upon. But I do want to acknowledge right off the bat, not so much the Kiplinger's article, which we'll read, but the meat and potatoes behind that article, this research report, does come, in my opinion, with a big asterisk and a big conflict of interest. I don't think two research fellows for the Retirement Income Institute, part of the Alliance for Lifetime Income, are going to come out with a research report that says, yeah, you can forget about annuities. Ken Fisher's right. So they do go in there, in my opinion, with a little bit of a jaundiced eye, preconceived notion. And I still feel comfortable with the article and the research report. Even though Chris and I will be making mention, the data set, we have to draw some conclusions from that data set because it doesn't accurately reflect what we feel is the people who typically listen to this podcast. I think the data set they use is very accurate. And again, we'll talk about it when we get to the research report. Very, very accurate, and no one's questioning it. But I think it represents a more broader scope of American society than the narrow scope of the people who generally listen to any podcast or hire any retirement planner. They're generally going to be people with $1 million or more, probably 2, 3, 4, 5 plus million of assets. Whereas the data set used in this research report pretty much looked at people with $1 million or less of assets and drew conclusions from that. But if we look at some of the conclusions that they drew, we can extrapolate how that may apply to you guys. I think their findings in the research report and in this Kiplinger's article are still going to carry through, even though they were based on a data set that probably doesn't include the vast majority of the people who listen to this podcast or the people who dive deep into their own retirement and geek out, what we call the VGers. Okay, I just wanted to make sure all of that was laid out there so none of you write to me saying, hey, I just wanted to take issue or umbrage with what you were talking about. Yes, the insurance industry sponsored all this. Yes, these guys are working for the insurance industry. And Blanchett is directly employed by Prudential. So there is that inherent conflict. The article from Kiplinger's doesn't get into that. I did. All right.
Okay.
So let's dive into, is there anything you want to add before I jump into, as you, I send it to you, Chris, it's only about five paragraphs long. It's very short, but it's going to get the juices flowing for us to talk. But anything that you want to add to anything I said, or just jump into the article?
No, I think, I guess one thing I'll add is that both Blanchett and Finke have shown to have, I mean, they have peer-reviewed research. And so I think they're actually pretty even-handed in their research. I don't think, where some bias might occur is they might not decide to delve into research that might be down a path that would be kind of anti-annuity or anti-insurance. They kind of on the front end, choose topics that tend to fit well with, you know, lifetime income. And so I think that's why they'd never step on the toes of on the insurance side. I don't think they're manipulating the research. I think they just happen to be doing research that, falls well into showing the benefits of lifetime income.
Oh, and I certainly didn't want to say that they were manipulating the research at all.
Yeah.
It's just one has to look at, I always do that. Whenever a study comes out, I want to look at who's sponsoring the study. Because I've yet to ever see a study sponsored by the Orange Institute that said orange juice is terrible for you. Oranges taste like crap, even though I love them more. I'm just making a point here. And orange trees should be cut down. You're not going to see that. So when I generally see a study, I always look, okay, great. This is beautiful. Who's sponsoring it?
Yeah.
And that to me is a big deal. Mm-hmm. Okay. So here's the article. The article was called Pinching Pennies. Don't leave joy on the table. If most of your wealth is in investments and savings, you are less likely in retirement to reap all the benefits of your hard work than if your money came from guaranteed income, like a pension. That's because retirees with income tend to spend more of their money. And then it quotes Michael Finke. It says, people, quote, people view wealth held in income as something they can spend, and wealth held in investments as something they should preserve, end quote, said Michael Finke, professor of economic security research at the American College of Financial Services, a private online university focused on professional training for financial practitioners. With pensions increasingly eclipsed by retirement savings accounts, the inclination of retirees to spend less has become a problem because, quote, it results in leaving joy on the table, a phenomenon economists called unintended bequests, end quote, adds Finke.
It's like accidental inheritance.
Yes. Yeah. Let's pause there, folks, because there was a lot of information in that paragraph. Actually, that was two paragraphs. I bled into the second paragraph. I usually pause after every paragraph. But what they're essentially saying there, and I'm sure you will agree, Chris, I have been saying this for years. I call it the bottomless cup of coffee. Mm-hmm. And that's what he's saying right here with his first quote of Michael Finke. People view wealth held in income as something they can spend and wealth held in investments as something they should preserve. I have said two little catch-alls from my show or my personal philosophical belief on retirement is twofold. First, I've always said when you retire, it's going to freak you out and you're going to be loath to spend your money. We see that anecdotally, but we see that constantly at our firm. Conversely, I have said income that comes to you month after month after month after month, you will spend. And the best analogy I have for that is the bottomless cup of coffee. That if you're at a cafe and you have your cup and they just filled it with coffee, now they leave a little carafe on your table. But back when I was a young kid growing up and going out to breakfast with my mom and father, and they had the coffee, the unlimited coffee, not me, they would have this little thick ceramic white mug. And then the hostess would come by or the waitress would come by with the coffee all the time. She'd have two in her hand. One had orange, and that was Sanka. And then she had the regular. And do you want regular or Sanka? And they would just come, constantly come. And when you have that constant money coming in, you feel totally comfortable spending it. When you have coffee being poured into your coffee mug, you don't care if you drink it. You don't care if you spill it. It's like, no big deal. I'll get more. And you will consume it and drink it to your heart's content. But if you entered retirement with a finite amount of coffee, you're not going to drink that coffee as readily. Even if you conceivably think, that's a lot of coffee there, I think it'll last. You're always going to be going, oh, what if I live a hell of a lot longer? Or what if I really like coffee? What if I have a wicked cold winter and I want to drink a lot of coffee? I better save this. And you tend not to want to drink the coffee, or in the more plausible approach of the metaphor, you feel more inclined not to spend your money. Anything you want to add on those first two paragraphs?
No, I think that's a key behavioral tendency that people need to acknowledge, that spending from the bottomless cup of coffee, the income, just feels, that's an emotion, feels a lot safer and more comfortable. And that comes from the lack of, you know, unpredictability, which means you don't have to worry about it going up or down or whatever. It's going to come in each and every month or quarter or whatever the timing is that you receive it. And so you feel, you know, you have emotional permission and financial permission to go ahead and spend it, because they're going to be by with a refill here shortly. And so it does make a big difference in the behavior of retirees. It's just, we see it time and time again.
Exactly. So the article again continues, and I'll pick up where I left off. Finca says, it results in leaving joy on the table, a phenomenon economists call unintended bequests. And this makes perfect sense, Finca says, because a retiree with a lifetime income source doesn't need to worry about money running out if they live to, say, age 100. They should rationally spend about 25% more. Now, the article goes on to say, and I skipped over this part, and I do want to make mention of it. Finca, who reached this conclusion in a research report he wrote with David Blanchett, head of retirement research at PGIM DC Solutions. That's the investment arm of Prudential, folks. And I did want to make mention of that, because it's that article that we're going to chat about a little bit after this article is done. Okay, so the article continues. Even so, he adds, meaning Finca, the difference in spending is larger than might be expected. Finca says retirees tend to want to keep their savings at the same level as they were when they first retired. For example, if you retire with $500,000 in an IRA, there may be a tendency to feel a loss if the balance falls below this amount, Finca says. This is known as loss aversion, and it is one of the reasons why so many retirees engage in behaviors such as only spending interest or dividends even if they don't have a strong desire to pass on any wealth after they pass away. There's a lot of good information there, or a lot of practical information that Chris and I see every day. Practical experience is a better way of putting it, that we see every day just in our practice, if you will. Anything you want to add, Chris, on that before I dive a little bit deeper into what was said?
Only that it's, I think, understandable that people have this emotional reaction to their investment balances going down. We might talk constantly in our industry, and we talk about it here on the show, that the reason why you built it up was to spend it. But people just who successfully built it up over decades know how much work it took to get it there. And they're proud of it. And they've generally seen it just go up. You know, there'll be certainly times during decades where it might have flattened out or gone down a little bit, but it went up way more than it went down. And they just don't like the thought of it going down, especially when they're not feeding it anymore, right? It's kind of got to sustain itself in their eyes. So I do think it's understandable, but if you simply are saying, I'm going to take this money and make it unavailable to me while I'm in retirement, you are setting up someone else to be able to spend it. We remind people all the time, someone's going to spend your money. While you're alive, you get to decide who that is. But someone's going to spend it. You need to decide who that's going to be. And sometimes that loosens up the purse strings a little bit for people that are averse to seeing their account balances go down through their own actions of spending. But I do think it's highly understandable why they feel that way about that money.
And I think it all comes down to how it's framed, it being your account balance. Y'all remember Tom Sawyer, Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer. If I remember correctly, I read both those. I believe it was Tom Sawyer who tricked his friends into painting a fence for him that he didn't want to paint because he framed it in a way that made them want to paint it. It was a task. It was a chore. He had to do it. He didn't want to do it, but he framed it. If I remember correctly, he framed it in a way of saying that they couldn't do it as well as him or something. I can't remember the exact trick he played, but it's all framing. He got them to believe doing a chore was something fun, and he got them to do something. I think we frame your retirement savings incorrectly. And I just said it incorrectly in my hypothesis. It should be framed as your retirement deferred spending. You shouldn't be told, and we're never going to change this, but you can change it individually at your level, all you VGers who refuse to spend from your portfolio. You need to start teaching yourself this is not money. It's deferred spending. That's how it needs to be framed. You need to be telling the younger folks, we're not telling you not to go out and spend those dollars and have fun. We're just saying do it later. Here's the money you're going to spend now, and just a little of it you're going to spend later. And if you go through life calling your 401k or even your Social Security, calling it income, your pension, calling it income, your annuities, calling it income, or spending income, might be a better way of putting it, and your actual physical savings in your IRA, your Roth, your 401k, calling it deferred spending, if you go into it knowing the aim is to spend these dollars, it's to consume them. It's not to die with it. It's not to be the richest person in the graveyard. It's not to try to grow it to a level where you're just going to live off of a measly little amount that it might earn in interest. It's to get you to understand this money is intended to be spent. We've been talking a lot lately about fixed indexed annuities with lifetime withdrawal benefits. And I've received several more emails on them. I had actually a phone call yesterday with a listener who I've met several times. I don't want to mention who he is. Actually, I can mention who he is because he's actually been on the show. So Kevin, oh goodness. I'm sorry, Kevin. I can't remember your last name. What's Kevin's last name, Chris?
Sebesta.
Not that Kevin, the other one.
Oh my gosh.
So see, I have an excuse. This is me.
Most recent was Sebesta, who was on the show, but yeah, it's right on the tip of my tongue. I'll remember it in just a second.
Oh goodness, he listens. He's laughing. Hopefully he's laughing and not getting mad.
But it's the Kevin comes on, talks more about lifestyle choices and having a rewarding and healthy retirement.
He's a retirement coach.
Yeah, it's more of a lifestyle coaching is his perspective usually. Yeah.
Anyways, as Chris researches Kevin's last name, and I apologize, Kevin. I have an excuse. Chris is supposed to be good with names, though. Okay, I had a discussion with him yesterday on the holiday on withdrawal benefits. Where I'm going with this, one of the things we tell people when you buy an annuity with these lifetime withdrawal benefits is you want to watch the account balance go down. You want to consume those assets. You want to spend it. Now, of course, there's a reason behind that. You want to watch them go down because when they reach zero, they're going to continue coming because they're being backed by an insurance company. But that's what we have to start teaching people about their quote-unquote savings, at least when it comes to their retirement portfolio. And by calling it deferred spending, gets the mindset in there, oh, I'm supposed to spend this. I'm supposed to consume this. I'm supposed to watch that go down. Now, of course, if you enter retirement with no backing outside of, say, perhaps Social Security, which isn't going to cover all of your expenses, but if you go into it with just savings, and that's the conclusion that Blanchett and Finca do create in their research report, that if there is no backstop to it, yeah, you fear because of the uncertainty of how long you're going to live. And this loss aversion, this behavioral finance concept of loss aversion, you start to see that money going down, it's going to panic you. But what I'm getting at is the framing. When you buy a single premium immediate annuity, we always tell people who work with us, those dollars are gone, you've turned them into income. If somebody was to buy a fixed indexed annuity with a living benefit rider, if we help somebody do that, then we would try to drill into their head, I want you to watch this money drop and reach zero. We frame it that way. We don't frame it as a loss of assets. If you buy the SPIA, you didn't lose assets. You just replace those assets with a stream of income. And we don't get people to think when they put money into a fixed indexed annuity with a withdrawal benefit that the idea is to still protect those dollars. No, the idea is to now live long enough that you watch those dollars reach zero. We're going to help you consume those. The intent is for those dollars to go down. The fact that those dollars, though, inside the annuity are going to have the added benefit that if I live long enough and it reaches zero, which is what I want it to do, I want this to go down. This is my bottomless cup of coffee. I want to watch this coffee being consumed. But if it runs out, goodness, this coffee just magically continues. In a traditional approach to retirement planning, that last bit of protection is gone. And I think that has a lot to do with why people are loath to spend their money. It's the same thing I said earlier. If you had a finite amount of coffee, you're going to be loath to drink all that coffee. You will die with extra coffee. But if you had coffee that just came consistently month after month after month after month, you're going to drink to your heart's content. You still may die with some coffee left over elsewhere, but you're going to feel comfortable drinking that coffee. Did you get Kevin's last name yet?
Yeah, it's Kevin Lyles.
Lyles! Ah, darn it. Sorry, yeah. Kevin, I couldn't remember your last name. But anyways, he and I chatted yesterday about these fixed index annuities with a withdrawal benefit. He wanted to share some things with me, and I had nothing going on, and we decided to chat yesterday on the holiday. Okay, let's get back to this article. So he also continues. He talked about, I'll pick up his quote with the loss aversion, folks. This is known as loss aversion, and it's one of the reasons so many retirees engage in behaviors such as only spending interest and dividends, even if they don't have a strong desire to pass on wealth after they die. Now he continues, quote, we also find that once required minimum distributions begin, people will spend more from IRA wealth. Now, this came in their research report that we'll get to. It is surprising, since they could have spent that money before RMDs begin, and they can just put the RMDs in a checking account. But instead, retirees frame the distributions as income. In essence, the government now has given them a license to spend their savings. I'm not quite sure I agree with all the conclusions that they're making there, but in this study, and we'll talk about the data set that they reference in this study they found that once RMDs began, people felt more comfortable spending not only those RMDs, but also spending from the IRA. But before the RMDs began, people were reluctant to spend from the IRA. They don't address, Chris, in my opinion, the emotional hurdle of taxes. People look at IRAs in the sense of, oh my God, I've got to pay taxes on that. I'm not going to take that money out. And I think a lot of the reasons that you see people sitting on money inside IRAs is because they either didn't do tax planning or they just fixated in their heads, they're going to delay the taxes as long as possible, put off that unpleasant feeling of sending money to the government in taxes as long as possible. I do feel, though, that yes, once RMDs begin, people do feel a little more comfortable spending it. I think they take the adage, well, if the government is forcing me to take it out, I might as well spend it. But there's many, many people that we run into, especially in the slow go and no go phase of life, where their RMDs are excessive. Not that their RMDs are excessive in the sense that I'm saying they're much too big. They saved way too much money. Nobody should have amassed that much wealth for retirement. That's not what I'm saying. That goes back to the wealth tax that used to be assessed on RMDs if they were greater than a certain amount. The IRA, well, Congress imposed a 15% surtax on your RMD if they felt it was too big. And that really ticked off a lot of people, and they got rid of that. But they actually had that rule. They could extrapolate how big your your IRA balance must be to be generating an RMD of that size. And they felt for somebody at that age, that IRA was too big. We used to call this success tax. You were too successful. We're going to put a 15% surtax on your IRA. They got rid of that. And that's not what I'm saying here. When I say you have an excessive RMD, you have an RMD that in conjunction with your secure income covers the rest of your minimum dignity floor. So everything above that is excessive. You don't need it. It's surplus, might be a better way of putting it. That is a surplus amount of RMD you don't need. And if you enter the slow go and no go phase of life, you very well may not be spending all of that surplus RMD on fun because your go-go phase is over. When you enter slow-go, you're slowing down. And when you're in no-go, you're pretty much not spending on fun. I'm not saying you don't do anything fun. You might rent a movie, but you're not going to be going on a trip or driving cross-country to visit grandkids or something like that. I got an email today from someone who sent me a photo of her and her husband looked like paragliding in Switzerland. Looked amazingly fun. Mm-hmm. And that's the go-go phase. You're not going to be doing that at 85. At least I don't think they'll be doing that at 85. So I do want to add my own caveat around this whole RMD thing, that once they begin, they start to see people maybe spending it, and they're drawing conclusions that people are saying the government has given me a license to spend, if you will. I think a lot of that is driven by people who are foolishly or erroneously drilled into their heads. Maybe not you guys, but you guys are an anomaly subset of American society. Most Americans don't follow their finances, and instead they're taught taxes, bad. Distributions from 401ks and IRAs, bad. Pre-tax savings, good. Just save, let it grow, and never pay taxes. That's what they teach you to do. And wait to the very last minute. Don't be proactive and do tax planning. So many people fall into that. Listen, I know you all find that hard to believe because most of you listening would never do that and you want to be proactive and start doing tax planning, but the vast majority of people don't. And I think it's taxes that are driving that low spending pre-RMD age. I don't think it's necessarily the government giving people a license to spend. Any thoughts on that? That's just my opinion, Chris. Any
Yeah,
thoughts
I would
on you?
agree that there's some people so averse to the thought of sending money as taxes when they, quote, don't have to, that they are resistant to pulling money out of a taxable account, like what we call always taxable, an IRA 401k style account. When in fact, what you should be remembering is that balance that you're seeing there on paper isn't all yours. A certain percentage of it, some 20 to 24%, maybe for many of you, that doesn't belong to you. That belongs to the government. You're just investing it for them. And if you delay it, you're going to grow it for them. Your part that is yours, the other, 70, 80% of it is yours. That's going to grow hopefully as well. But you're not going to get out of the taxes. You're not going to make more of that portion that's going to go to the government yours by holding it longer. It's just not how it works. It's just, so it's another framing issue where you've got to probably give up that money claim, the mental claim on that money that's going to go in taxes and realize it's not yours to begin with. It's, you're not getting it. You're in, you can't control. The only way you're going to get that money to somebody else is if you give it to a charity. And otherwise somebody's going to pay taxes on it, most likely you, as you go to try to use it. But delaying it is not going to make it less painful. It's but hopefully remembering it's not yours to begin with maybe is a way to lessen that feeling and maybe take money and spend it on yourself, knowing that yes, the government's going to get some of what's theirs as well.
Perfect. And then the article wraps up with this paragraph, folks. The report suggests ways to encourage more spending. And then it continues quoting Finca. Quote, for example, policies, and not life insurance policies or annuity policies, they mean regulatory policies. For example, policies that incentivize or default the annuitization of retirement wealth could significantly increase spending amount for retirees. I'm going to pause there and say, I hope that never passes. Incentivizing, yes. Defaulting to annuitization or forced annuitization of some of a person's assets, no. I do not feel the government should do that. I do feel, and that's my personal approach, everybody can disagree with me. I think, though, incentivizing, sure. Maybe similar to how the government incentivizes employer matches, maybe come up with, hey, if you put money in an annuity option, the government will put a little bit of money in there for you, maybe up to a certain level of wealth, maybe not the level of income of people listening to this show, but y'all know the Social Security Fantasy Act for government employees and nobody else's, I like to call it, really irks me because we have a lot of people suffering as they age with a little bit of, with very little secure income. Maybe rather than allowing certain people to be able to keep a lot of income, they make it more fair and maybe incentivize lower paid workers by saying, hey, if you direct some of your money into your 401k, you get an employer match. But if you put some in the annuity option or the annuitization option, we, the government, if you have income below a certain level, we'll put even some money in for you. I'm just thinking out loud. So I don't mind incentivizing, and especially if they're means tested to help those truly who need it. But defaulting to annuitization, mandating or forcing annuitization, I don't care for that. But I do feel there must be better education. That's where I'm going on this. If people were educated more, it's not going to help y'all listening to this. But if you guys who are the vanguard and you're going to be dealing with your kids and your grandkids and your neighbors and your friends and your colleagues, people who are 20, 30, 40 years younger than you, if you could be telling them that, hey, everything you're hearing about annuities and annuitization and income isn't quite as bad as what Wall Street wants you to believe. Keep an open eye to it and save as much as you can. And then maybe, yes, in the future, you will want to buy some income. And get them to understand what they're putting aside is not an asset. It's deferred spending. It's their money. They just haven't spent it yet. I know that's a nuance, but it's a framing that I do feel will help people go, oh, yeah, I get it. I'm supposed to consume that, and get them to feel that way. So then it wraps up. He says, for example, managed payout funds designed to distribute a percentage of wealth each year can help retirees frame savings as income. That's a good example. I don't think that is from Finca. I believe that is the author. Oh, no, that is a Finca quote as well. So he's saying, in addition to annuity options, a managed payout fund. They've been around for a while. They've never really caught on. Are you familiar with them, Chris?
Somewhat, but they're not super popular yet. At least haven't been.
Vanguard has some of the more popular ones, and they manage a payout for a certain period of time. They're not guaranteed. They can go up. They can go down. But it is true. It kind of takes what target date funds did for accumulation planning and dumb it down to the lowest common denominator to appeal to a lot of people who don't have the ability to do what you VGers do, and maybe don't have the assets or desire to work with an advisor to put a spending plan in place. A managed payout fund could be a wonderful option. One place I have never seen managed payout funds is inside 401ks.
Yeah.
You have all these default investment options of target date funds, which do a, I won't say wonderful job, but a reasonable job of helping people accumulate wealth. Why don't they have the same for retirement? To say, hey, if you stay in the 401k after you retire, we have this whole group of funds over here. These are institutionally priced 401k available, managed payout funds that will help you manage and spend your assets. And by pooling them together, you can often get a higher withdrawal percentage than the perceived 4% rule. Or now a lot of people are starting to say, hey, if you retire older, and that's when you're retiring, you can take out more than someone who retires younger. So it would be kind of the opposite of target date funds. Target date funds says if you are older, we're going to have less of your money in growth and more in fixed income. And if you are younger, we're going to have more in growth. Maybe in my vision, they have this post-retirement investment options of managed payout funds or other type of funds. And if you retire younger, I'm retiring at 55, your managed payout fund won't pay as much as somebody who retires at 70. Because at 70, they might be able to say, or should be able to say, gee, you have a shorter life expectancy. We're going to be able to give you a managed payout of this amount. And they just have a suite of managed payout funds. Again, I'm just thinking out loud, but it's just getting me and hopefully you guys to understand managing retirement and overcoming the emotional hurdles of spending your money and overcoming the knowledge that we're not getting younger, stronger, and healthier, and dealing with the risk of outliving your money and cognitive decline and our health changing, and sadly, family and friends and colleagues and associates and neighbors are all dying as we age. This happens. Having an option that is simple and automates a lot of this, much as it did during the accumulation phase, only makes sense. Yet 401ks, Chris, have none of that. They have a target date fund that's not designed to manage payouts at all. To me, a target date fund did great to getting into retirement. They need a whole suite of options post-retirement, and they don't. They want you to stay in the 401k and choose from the same damn investment options that a 20-year-old is choosing, who's just starting his or her career. That is just bass-ackwards. And that's probably a reason why many people do move their 401ks. And sadly, they'll move into a 401k with a questionable AUMer who's going to start taking 1, 1.5, 1.25, whatever the case may be, of their assets. And if they were given better institutional shares and options inside their 401k, maybe they could keep more money in their pocket and not give tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars over the course of their retirement to Wall Street for quote-unquote management fees. Okay, I'll get off my high horse there. Anything you want to add?
No, not at this point.
Okay. So Chris and I just want to share a little bit, and I sent you, Chris, a few talking points since you didn't have a chance to read the article. So you should be getting an email from me shortly of some talking points that I put together of the article. And I did want to make mention of it, and I'm going to link to it, because there were some, to me, important takeaways that they got. It wasn't an article. I'm sorry. It's a research report. It's the research report that this article was quoting, if you will. One of the things that struck me the most, Chris, and you might have seen this in the article, is at the beginning, they begin by saying, or at least on the first couple of pages, that retirees are hesitant to spend from their nest egg. And in the study, they found that, I'm trying to see here, here's my notes here. It says, retirees use much larger share of lifetime income. Now, I do take a little, they're much smarter than me, these people, so I'm sure they have rational reasons for what they did. But they did find, one of the things that struck me is that retirees spend, they say use, I say spend, a much larger share of their lifetime income, Social Security, pension, and income annuities. Now, where have we heard that before, Chris? Social Security, pension, and income annuities. Anywhere you ever heard that before, those three put together like that?
Occasionally. People.
And where would that be?
Bunch them into a group called secure income.
Secure income, exactly. What they found is on average, roughly 4/5 of Social Security pension and income from annuities is spent. But when you spend from savings, capital income, and wages, it lags much further behind. They spend less than half of that. And I couldn't quite understand what it meant by wages, not ages. And if you read through the research report, they will begin to explain to you their philosophy on wages. And what they found is as people tiring and they were working less. They're working part-time. They're working less often, inconsistently. They found that a lot of the money they earned in wages went to withholdings. So in other words, folks went to taxes or was driven back into savings and wasn't actually consumed. I think taxes is the act of consumption, Chris. I mean, the IRS says all money is fungible. So if people are working and are sending a lot of that money at work in taxes, that does allow them to take more money or additional dollars from their savings, if you will, and not have to send that to the government in taxes, and they can spend it. So I do feel sending wages to the government in taxes is spending. So again, when they say about half of wages are spent, they are looking at all the households, and keep in mind, folks, where wage income tends to be part-time, not as often, inconsistent, and is sent in taxes. So that's why they put wages in that category. But without a doubt, spending from assets and spending from capital, and what they're defining as that capital income, they're talking either unrealized capital gains or dividends and things of that nature, is not spent nearly as heavily as the 80 to 85% of Social Security, pension, and income annuities that is spent. And that's one of the takeaways that really, I guess, stuck out with me in this research report. One thing I did want to do, though, is I wanted to know who are they looking at in this research report? Because the research report was based on a lot of information. The data came from the University of Michigan, folks. You'll see this all in the research report. Came from the University of Michigan's Health and Retirement Study. And this was supposed to be it's a small subset. It was about 7,500 people. But according to the University of Michigan, it was a national representation of Americans over the age of 50. They ran this study every 2 years since 1992. So there is a lot of data in here. And it was supported by the National Institute on Aging and Social Security. So the Blanchett and Finca used this data and they say the authors combined the HRS income and asset data with a companion spending survey called CAMS to see what retirees actually spend from different sources. And that's how they drew their conclusion of what retirees spent from Social Security, pension, annuities, wages, capital income, and savings. So that was pretty good data set. However, I wanted to research that data set a little bit more. So I went down to ChatGPT and I told it, hey, can you find out a little bit more about this data set? And who the people are and their ages and how they would carry over or reflect maybe a population of people with $1 to $5 million of assets. And what they found or what chat shared with me is that people in this study were broken down into two categories. And it was generally people with $500,000 or less and then $1 million or less. So they weren't really doing a lot of research at people with the 1 to say 5 million level of assets. And I was a little unsure if the information would be as applicable, but as I thought about things, I do feel it would be equally applicable. I think the conclusions that they're drawing can also convey to people with $1, $2, $3, $4 million. Now, would it convey to people with 10, 15, 20, 30 million? No. Those are a different subset of American society. I understand what the researchers were doing. They were trying to capture a more broad swath of American society, maybe not necessarily just people with 1 to 4 or 5 million of assets. Anything you want to add, though, Chris, to that on the extrapolation of those findings or anything?
Well, I think a lot of this is kind of entrenched in human behavior. And I don't think, the one thing common in all retirees is they're all human. So while there's all, you know, a spectrum of how humans behave, when we see a tendency for humans being human to act a certain way, I think it's going to be true whether they have 500,000, a million, 5 million, or what have you. When you boil down the numbers, the actual financial situation they face might be very different. Their tendency to behave certain ways actually stays fairly consistent. So I also don't think it's too much of a stretch to apply some of these observations, these conclusions, if you will, to a set beyond what they initially studied.
Okay, perfect. So a couple of the takeaways that really made me go, wow, and that were captured in this article, the Kiplinger's article. Kiplinger's is the article, this is the study. And I think some of the things that stood out for me is in the results they found, retirees spend a much larger share, as I've said, of lifetime income over other income sources. They claim, again, looking at the data, that 80 to 85% of lifetime income is spent, while only half of wage income, capital income, and savings is spent. They go on to again say why it looks like wages are underspent, and again, they tie it into the shorter part time and the occasional employment, and that a lot of it goes to earnings, and, excuse me, to taxes. But that was one of the things that they took away from that. The other thing it says is it highlights behavioral frictions, uncertainty, complexity, and the tendency to experience withdrawals as losses. Let's repeat that. Why are they only spending? Why do people only spend about half or less of their actual savings while spending up to 80 to 85% of income? And not capital income. They're talking specifically Social Security, pension, and income annuity. They turned it out to behavioral aspects. The uncertainty, how long am I going to live? That is huge. How long am I going to stay healthy? How long am I going to live? How long does this money have to last? The complexity. We have said that repeatedly in our approach to retirement planning. One of the reasons we like covering food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare expenses, 5 broad categories we call the minimum dignity floor. Those are 5 broad categories of lifetime expenses you will always incur, no matter how long you live. Why not cover it with a lifetime stream of guaranteed income from Social Security, pension, and income annuity? And it will provide a steady stream of hopefully inflation-adjusted or properly inflation-adjusted dollars. We don't get into the show on how we do that. We've done on many other shows. If it is covered and matched with that bottomless cup of coffee, and if you knew your minimum dignity floor was taken care of, you would feel emotionally, we hope, more inclined to spend money on fun. But it also solves for what Blanchard and Finkel was saying, the complexity of a distribution portfolio. I think it's paralysis by analysis. People just freak out on that alone. It's not even watching their account balance go down. It's them trying to replace a lifetime stream of wages. I won't say lifetime, but a working lifetime stream of wages. Kind of trying to replace that with withdrawals from assets, when most people don't even have a clue on how to manage their assets. Not you guys listening to this. I'm talking about everybody else. So I think the complexity does play a role in this. But even for people with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 million, we still favor our approach because it removes the uncertainty. Blanchard and Finca are listing right off the bat uncertainty. Well, if you knew your minimum daily flow was covered with secure income that you cannot outlive and will continue for as long as you have a pulse and can fog a mirror, it kind of removes the uncertainty, not totally, because there's always going to be inflation uncertainty, but it removes a lot of the uncertainty of your minimum dignity floor. Well, it also removes a lot of the complexity. I told you when my dad passed away, he didn't know much about investing anymore or numbers or fractions. I shared all these stories with you. This from the man in his younger years who was a math whiz and taught me math. But he always knew the third Wednesday of the month his Social Security check came. That's simplicity. That's replacing complexity with simplicity. Even if you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 million of assets amassed, yes, at 65, you're probably still smart enough to handle it and understand what's going on. But do you feel you could do so at 85? Do you feel you could do so the day after you just suffered a stroke or a heart attack? Or maybe you've been diagnosed with Parkinson's, or maybe your spouse just passed away or is suffering some issues and your mind is being pulled in other directions. Or maybe you're just aging, because after the age of 53, the part of our human brain that understands financial concepts begins to decline. We've talked about that many, many times. So they listed specifically the hesitation of spending your savings. Uncertainty, complexity, but here's another big one. The tendency to treat experienced withdrawals as, quote, losses. If your portfolio drops, whether it drops from market losses or you spending it, it still freaks you out. Because for some reason, you're ingrained in the head that you should have the same amount of money on day one of retirement, 5 years into retirement, 10 years into retirement, 20 years into retirement, to the last day of retirement when you die. It's like you're supposed to die with the same amount of money you started with. I don't know who started that. I don't know why people still believe that, but I do feel framing it as delayed spending might get people to spend it rather than die with it. That's what I took away from this. Now, I gave you a little bit of time to read, Chris. Anything you took away?
Well, I do think it aligns quite well with a lot of what we talk about, and I think that's because what we've developed in our philosophy and our approach was really to deal with these behavioral issues in retirement. If it was purely a, you know, finance question, living in retirement, there'd be a lot of ways academically that you could navigate retirement. But what a lot of the approaches that are somewhat standard or commonplace out there don't hit head on the behavioral issues that this paper keeps focusing on, as well as, you know, our approach. We take a little different approach. They're talking more generically in the research about income and spending on all of your expenses, which implies, you know, they'd spend more on fun if it was from income instead. But unlike your minimum dignity floor, as you've pointed out many times on the show, your minimum dignity floor goes forever as long as you're breathing. Fun is a little different. It tends to be uneven throughout retirement, with the greatest opportunity to spend on fun to be during the early go-go period. So income really is lifetime income in particular seems to fit better as far as a coverage mechanism, a resource to cover expenses when those expenses are fairly stable over time. You know, maybe growing with inflation, but are recurring and stable because that income is most likely going to be recurring and stable. Those seem to be good partners. I think what the distinction they're not making in the paper that we tend to make is that, use your other resources, your assets, if you will, for fund spending, because they will kind of deal with that unevenness of spending with a go-go or super-go or whatever you want to describe it early on, and then maybe very minimal as far as fund budget later on. When you're 85, 90, 95, you might be living happily, covering your minimum dignity floor expenses, and then doing a handful of things on a regular basis that makes you happy, playing cards, visiting with friends, having coffee in the morning with your friends, maybe in your community, or if you happen to be in some type of assisted living or something like that. It's a whole different world than when you're in your 60s, 70s, when you're active enough to be, you know, paragliding or what have you, is an extreme. Doesn't have to be that extreme, but you get the point, is you're physically able to do a whole lot more things younger. And so if you set up income, lifetime income, to cover those things, you probably have an overabundance of income later. So it doesn't fit the profile, the timeline, if you will, of the fund spending as much, at least in my opinion, compared to, say, a minimum dignity floor coverage, which is why we tend to focus on the secure income covering that.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, because one of the things the research report does not dive into, it just dives into saying, and if you go through it, they give a very simplistic example of a married couple and a single person. And they said adding annuity income, can increase the spending that a married couple will do by 100%, and for a single person by 30 or 40. I don't have the exact amount in front of me, folks. I apologize. The married couple one surprised me. Now, if you read the study, you'll see it's a rather simplistic example they gave, but again, they're basing it off of the data. And one of the things that I guess I disagree with, or maybe there's a specific reason they didn't dive into it, they just talk about annuitization or a lifetime stream of guaranteed income tied to your quote-unquote spending. They don't break it out between minimum dignity floor spending. They don't have to use our definition of food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare expenses. But those, they don't break it out into, I guess the industry sometimes calls it wants and needs, required, desired. They just bungle it all into one. And that's one area where Chris and I tend to draw the line. I don't particularly like to annuitize fund spending because of the extreme variability of fund spending. And because fund spending may not necessarily last your entire life. But minimum dignity floor, it's not variable. We can get fairly close in estimating, especially if you update your analysis every few years with actual inflation experiences. But we can take decades of inflation data, draw some conclusions of how much to inflate food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare expenses, recognizing past performance, no guarantee of future results. But that's why updating it on a semi-regular basis is important. And I feel we can get pretty much on target, maybe not the bullseye, but on target, or you if you're doing it yourself, of minimum dignity floor expenses. They're not extremely variable. That food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare happen to everyone. Now, true, they'll say, but as we age, we're going to consume more healthcare. Yes, but to a degree. But I will tell you, at a 57-year-old, I consumed more healthcare than I ever have and hopefully ever will. I had a $250,000 expense just for my stroke, $114,000 for my first ablation, $100-something thousand for my second ablation, $89,000 for the helicopter ride that took me to the trauma center. I hope not to see those numbers for a long time. So the notion that only older people have big healthcare expenses, that's not true. For the most part, minimum dignity floor is smooth, constantly rising for inflation, and will continue forever. The perfect expenses to tie to a steady, slow, always dribbling in monthly stream of guaranteed income. Very difficult for fun. Gee, Jim, this month we're going to go do this. Give us $30,000. Gee, Jim, next month we're staying home. We got COVID. We don't need anything. Extreme example, but ones that we've seen. You can't cover an extremely volatile expense with this steady income. You might be saying, how could you do that with healthcare? Also, what we're trying to do is cover the premiums of Medicare, which are fairly flat, steady, and known, the premiums of a Medigap policy, or the out-of-pocket expenses of a Medicare Advantage policy. Those you can cover, you can flatten, if you will, amortize over the course of a life. Those expenses are designed to cover the massive unknown expenses of healthcare. So that's how we can put it, just in case some of you were going to come back and say, well, how can you put healthcare in this? You had this massive expenses at 57 and 58 and then nothing. Because all's what I had to cover every year was my $9,000 deductible and my annual premiums, which were around $900 to $1,100 a month. I had to cover the premiums of my Obamacare healthcare and then the $9,000 deductible. And then everything else was covered, even though the expenses themselves were hugely variable. That's what I'm trying to get at. But fund spending is so variable, it doesn't lend itself well to a lifetime stream of guaranteed income, because then you're still, oh God, I really wanted to go on this trip this year and take my family with me, but it's going to take me 4 years to save up the money because my fund spending is also being limited. That we don't want people to have to do. And that's one of the reasons. But the other reason is fun does not last the rest of your life. As much as we want to say, I'm going to be 85 and doing this, bull. I just talked to my mom today at 86. I'm going to go to Florida again with her. And we're planning some things to do, which would be quote unquote fun for her and fun for me, not only because of my mom, but we're going to go see another comedian. She had fun at the comedy show I took her to in Venice. And she said today she'd like me to take her to another one and she's looking forward to it. And that for her is fun and I'm going to enjoy it too, but it's probably only going to cost me $300-$400, mostly because I want to get her good seats right up front. It's not a huge expense, but it's still fun for an 86-year-old. But when she was in her 60s, and especially still married to her second husband or dating him at that point, they traveled all over the place and had fun and spent money to their heart's content. That's why we tend to favor the protection through Social Security, pension, and income annuities of minimum dignity floor. And I think another takeaway, Chris, and then you can wrap up or add your own thoughts, is they didn't play up in this study to first optimize Social Security to then look for those of you who have pensions and analyze pensions appropriately and look at the secure income that that can generate before purchasing an annuity. It was just saying that, hey, if you annuitized some of your wealth, you're going to spend more. And then they give the example of a married couple spending 100% more with annuitization than they did pre-annuitization, and a single person explaining why 40-ish or 50-ish percent more. Again, not faulting them. These two men forget more in one day than I'll ever know. But I just tend to look at things slightly different. and apply. I'm a firm believer in annuitization, but not just random any pool of money or any expenses, just minimum dignity for the reasons I shared. What say you as you wrap this up, Chris?
Well, I do think that secure income can play a fabulous foundational role in your retirement. And a lot of people dismiss or overlook existing secure income. So your point about making sure to optimize what you naturally have first before seeking additional. And then the additional that you seek can be any number of approaches. We prefer to embellish your Social Security, if that's your only source of secure income, with extra annuitized income if you need it to cover minimum dignity floor expenses that might be projected at some point in your life that your Social Security might not be expected to cover well. That's kind of our method for determining how much, because that's always a big question. There's people who might be convinced an annuity might work for them, but aren't sure how big of one to get. And I think, having a predefined what job do you want it to do approach can help clarify that. We have defined that in our let's cover minimum dignity floor with secure income stance in our philosophy. But there's others. There's certainly ways you could, cover maybe a base level of fund that you expect to have throughout your life and maybe annuitize that. And then just keep for spike spending and go-go splurges, then you draw from your other assets. Have, other pools of reserves for unanticipated events or just an extra cushion that helps people sleep at night, that you wouldn't have annuitized as well. But there's a lot of different approaches to answering the question, how much should I annuitize? And many times the answer, the natural answer is none. There's plenty of cases where people just, don't face the threats that annuities are good at helping you with, good at reducing those risks. If those risks aren't significant for you, then you have to ask yourself, is an annuity really the right thing for me? And there's lots of paths to success. You can certainly have a successful retirement, without taking the approach of covering any portion of your expenses with income. But you're going to face head on some of those headwinds of behavioral finance that we talk about. Even if you have, quote, plenty of money, I still think we see a lot of underspending with people because they are so worried about retaining assets rather than using them for their own benefit and happiness in retirement. And if it can get you off that behavioral, sticking point, maybe an annuity for people that would seemingly have no natural need for it because they have more money than they could possibly spend over a lifetime. So the natural argument for a lifetime annuity is to give you longevity protection. If that's not an issue, maybe there's still a behavioral reason you should consider it. So just some food for thought out there. A lot of different ways to slice things up and approach your retirement, but hopefully this got you thinking a little bit about your circumstances and what might work for you.
Yeah, I hope it does challenge people to think of their preconceived notions that they probably entered retirement in. The Ken Fisher, I hate annuities and so should you. I'm going to use Monte Carlo safe withdrawal rate approach to retirement. And I hope our approach, whether or not you adopt it or not, is up to you. Or a form of it. That's what the dialogue series is for. That maybe it's got you thinking that, hey, wow, yeah, there is something to this food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare. There is something to the fact that, geez, after age 53, that part of my brain is degrading, even though I refuse to admit it now. Someday I'm going to be the other guy. Maybe there is going to be that emotional hurdle. I may have enough wealth, but what good is it if I don't feel comfortable spending it? Or more importantly, the whole concept of our fund number. Okay, yeah, I entered retirement with $3 million. How much of it can I spend on fun? What do I need for minimum dignity floor? Whether I'm going to cover it with withdrawals or income, I still need to know how much of my 3 million needs to go to minimum dignity floor. How much should I put towards aging, a buffer and a reserve? What's left for me to spend on fun? That is what we strive to do, and that's what we strive to teach you guys. But I want to challenge you, challenge your train of thought, to what you think you're going to do and encourage you to spend the majority of your fun in your go-go years. Nobody knows how long that's going to be. Sometimes people come in with a fairly hard, nope, Jim, once I'm 75, we're slowing down. And there's some people who are truly like that. They've got it worked out in their head. But for most of us, we don't know when that go-go phase is going to end. But we do know, chances are, if we're retiring between 62 and 65, our go-go phase will probably last to maybe 73 to 80. It's a big window, but that's about it. And then after that, your ability to spend on fun is greatly reduced. And what we're going to try to encourage you to do through the help that Blanchett and Finca are trying to show, the comfort, the emotional comfort to spend on fun that a lifetime stream of guaranteed income can provide. Not because you're going to earmark it towards spending on fun. The emotional comfort of spending your remaining assets on fun, knowing the older you was taken care of. I've said this a lot. It's been a long time. We'll wrap up with this. That our approach to retirement planning is an explicit promise to the older you that their food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare expenses are taken care of. And in return, the older you is given an implicit permission to spend on fun. I say implicit because you do have to monitor it on a semi-regular basis throughout retirement to make sure the assumptions that were made still hold true and that the minimum dignity flow of the old you is still adequately protected and covered. But that's what it is. Your promise for your permission to spend on fun and then spend it during your go-go years to your heart's content. Okay, Chris.
Yeah. So we want to thank everybody for listening and thank everybody for sending in these articles as something for us to consider chatting about. If you want to send in your own feedback to the show, including questions for the Q&A show, just send them to Jim directly, jim@jimhelps.com. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Put in the subject line, it's a question or comment for the podcast. Include a word or two about the topic as well. That's always helpful up in the subject line, so it's easy to catch Jim's attention. And yeah, I think that's about it. So, Jim, I'll talk to you soon, and everyone else, stay safe, and we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.